Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Album.
Excuse me.
You're welcome.
Guitar up.
One,
turn
two,
that guitar three.
I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Robbie Robertson concludes our exploration of the best of the band.
Life is a carnival. It's in the book. Life is a carnival. Take another look.
After the Woodstock Festival, it changed everything. It became the most famous small town in the world at that time. And here they came, and it became very, very touristy, very hippie touristy, and that was somewhat interesting for a while, but then it wore off, and it started a darkness settled in, a dark cloud kind of settled over the place, and that original charm for the people that had lived there so long and all of these artists and everything, they started feeling somewhat betrayed.
Acadian driftwood, gypsy tailwind, they call my home the land of snow. Canadian cold run, moving air, what a way to ride, oh, what a way to go.
Hi, this is Robbie Robertson in the studio for the band's A Musical History, Part 2.
Ironic how the one band in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with the most generic name imaginable has turned out to be possibly the most unique of all, and certainly one of the most enduring influences on American music to this day. Prior to the band's music from Big Pink album in 1968, rock and roll was pretty much about youth culture. You know, young love, fast cars, and cruising the boulevards, played almost exclusively by electric guitars at ever-increasing volume. The band, however, wrote about mature themes in historical and regional context, often in rural settings populated by simple folk that they called by name, which gave the songs an intimacy usually reserved for literature, not pop music. And all of these songs were performed by the multi-instrumentalists in the band themselves. Drummer-singer Levon Helm could nimbly switch to mandolin. Pianist-singer Richard Manuel could slide behind the drums. And organist Garth Hudson could play tuba instead of Rick Danko's bass guitar when the arrangement called for it. Most significantly, though, the song lyrics of guitarist Robbie Robertson were not idealizing their lives, as so much of the second-generation rock was prone to do. The band was almost quaintly autobiographical, and that storied move to upstate New York in the Catskill Mountains near the town of Woodstock, that was about to change. Here's Robbie Robertson.
Well, when we first went to Woodstock, I guess in 67 or something, when we moved up there from New York City, when we were working with Bob, Albert Grossman was the one who talked us into doing that, because he just thought that it's where we could find the privacy, really, to be able to put our music together, because the idea was for us now to make a record of our own. When we went up there, it was this charming little art colony, and there was a beautiful innocence to it. It had great charm, and there was no scene, there was no nothing there, except the quality of life, and a lot of people had lived there for many, many years. So when we went up there, it served our purpose that we were able to put our music together. We found this house, Big Pink, that we were able to do all of the basement tapes in and music, get the music music from Big Pink together. All of these kind of things, it all was just lovely the way it all laid out. After the Woodstock Festival, it changed everything. It became the most famous small town in the world at that time. And And here they came. And it became very, very touristy, very hippie touristy. And that was somewhat interesting for a while. But then it wore off, and it started to, a darkness settled in. You know, a dark cloud kind of settled over the place. And that original charm for the people that had lived there so long and all of these artists and everything, they started feeling somewhat betrayed by what had happened to their, you know, their innocence in this place. And there was nothing that anybody could do about it. The reason they called it the Woodstock Festival was only because the band and Bob Dylan lived in Woodstock up there, and it had this, you know, somewhat of a story behind a story in it, you know, that there was a mystery, and what are they doing up there in those mountains, and it was embracing that, you know, with all good intentions and everything. Nobody, you know, meant any real harm by it. But the fact that the Woodstock Festival wasn't even in Woodstock, it was like quite a distance away, actually. But what the repercussions had on this place is, you know, it just made everything change. And the whole style, lifestyle up there, it became different. And people were just showing up at your doorstep. And that whole sense of being, you know, off the map a little bit and in a place where you could really just concentrate on your work and your art and not have to think about these other things would no longer apply to the place. So it wore out for me after a while, and I felt like we needed to shuffle the deck. I thought we needed something just different and refreshing. So I just wanted something new, and I left there, and I came out to the West Coast, and then the guys all came out after that, and Bob Dylan was out living in Malibu too, and it was just a wave to the West. Go West, young man, and we did.
Life is a Carnival appeared on the 1971 album Cahoots by the band, sounding rollicking and joyous. That stems from a collective confidence by that time, buoyed by critical raves for each of their first three albums, as well as good fortune with several unconventional hit singles by then. That self-confidence was tested mightily in 1966 as Bob Dylan's new electric rock and roll band, and rewarded 8 years later when Dylan returned to the stage after a self-imposed exile. Here's Robbie Robertson.
When we played together and did that tour in 1966, this was now 8 years later, and people had kind of given up on it. It had fallen off the expectation map, and so when we did decide to do this, it seemed like a surprise all over again, where before that it wouldn't have been a surprise at all. And just enough time had passed, and it was interesting because we were coming from a place that the last time that we had done a tour together, where we played all over not only North America, but in Australia and Europe as well, that people booed us every night that we went out and played. And in 1974, we were doing pretty much what we had done then. I mean, it wasn't night and day at all. You know, we were maybe, you know, a little bit more solid in our confidence in what we were doing because people weren't booing every night. But in 1974, when we decided to do this, it was really interesting to see that everybody that before had said, you know, that this is an outrage, this mixing folk music and electric music together, and these people should burn in hell for this, that now in 74, everybody was like, this is the real deal. This is the second coming. This is blah, blah. And it was, it was just extraordinary that the world revolved around. We didn't do anything really different, but the world did. And they came around to this thing and not only accepted it, but looked at it like it was some kind of a revelation.
Robbie Robertson's blazing guitar solos on that 1974 live performance by the band with Bob Dylan are matched on that performance by Garth Hudson's unique organ playing.
Your quote about Garth Hudson, quote, "He was able to combine in 20 seconds of playing 10 uniquely different influences, and you could hear them all. Give a few examples that we'd all be able to relate to on this box set."
Well, in all of the whole story of, you know, rock and roll music, or whatever you want to call it, of all the different kinds of bands that have come along, and a lot of them over the years have had, you know, some very interesting and musical keyboardists. But in that, on that playing field, to this day, there is still nobody in the league of Garth. There's just nobody that can do and has the musical library, you know, that he carries around inside of himself, and has this ability, this improvising ability. It's just above and beyond what people in rock and roll bands know how to do. And when we first asked Garth to join the Hawks, it was almost intimidating, his advanced musicality, that he could have just as easily been playing with the Dallas Symphony Orchestra,
really,
or Miles Davis, as he could with us. I mean, he had those kind of chops, and could pull them out and at any given second. He could, you know, he could be playing the most authentic official gospel music that you've ever heard, and then, you know, and without taking a breath, we would be so deep into Gregorian chants you wouldn't know where you were. and could make this all work in the context of the songs that I was writing, the way that he would complement the songs. But he wasn't, usually these guys, they play like a, whatever they call it, a pad or a filler or something. Garth never played filler. He didn't do filler.
Did Garth ever tell you then, if he could have played for anybody, why did he play with you?
I think that he found a niche that was somewhere in knowing our musical adventures that we had in mind, of how we wanted to grow and what we wanted to learn, and that his place in the band would not be only just to perform amazing musicianship, but also to help us further our own musical abilities too. That appealed to him, the idea that he could be responsible for just raising our musical bar to another place, as well as just him being off in his own world. That made him really feel a part of everything. And we so admired and accepted Garth for everything that he was, that I think he just felt a very natural attraction to where we were going musically and us as people. I think we made him feel good and feel at home. In the beginning, there was certain hesitations with him, and it could be just a trial situation, and we'll see where it goes. But there was no looking back for us. Once Garth was in the fold, we just felt better about everything.
If there's a bookend, then, to tell me about writing Acadian Driftwood. Some songs, I know the great ones will say that some of these come in 5 minutes. I don't think that one came in 5 minutes.
Well, it didn't come in 5 minutes because I needed to know a little bit more than what I knew without doing a little bit of research. But what sparked the idea was I was living in Montreal part-time when I was the idea came up to write this song. And I was watching a show on television one night, and it was called L'Acadie, L'Acadie. And it was the story of the Acadians, and it was on French television there. So I was watching this story being told in French and seeing this footage and old photographs of it. And because of me being from Canada, and what happened in this story is these people from Canada ended up going down south and living in the south. There was a parallel to my own story in this, but I've always really enjoyed Cajun music and Zydeco music. And the fact that this originally came from Canada, there was something about that that I felt a certain connection to that that I couldn't let go of. And I wanted to tell the story of this music, but rather than talking about the music, I wanted to talk about the actual history of how this music came about. So telling the story about, you know, in Canada, there was a war years ago between the English and the French, and the English won, and the French then were outcasts, and all these people that lived in that eastern part of Canada were then outcasts immediately. They had moved, you know, thousands and thousands of families had moved to that area, and then somebody has a war, and all of a sudden they're like, okay, folks, you don't belong here anymore. And they're like, I know, but we don't have like a bus ticket to get home. You know, we're not in a position to. So these people, you know, were homeless in a certain sense, of culture and pride.
Coming up next, Robbie Robertson does a touching tribute to the band's dearly departed drummer and singer, Levon Helm. The band's 7 studio albums, plus their seminal Rock of Ages concert album, have been remastered and artwork beautifully restored into the 9-LP vinyl box set of the band, the Capitol Albums 1968 to 1977. Click on it now at Amazon.com. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio with Robbie Robertson for the conclusion of The Best of the Band.
Welcome back. In the studio, I'm Robbie Robertson with Redbeard.
More than a bandmate, more than a talented actor who appeared as Chuck Yeager's wingman in the movie The Right Stuff and as Loretta Lynn's father in Coal Miner's Daughter, more than the double Grammy Award winner as recently as 2008 and 2009, the late singing drummer and mandolin player Levon Helm was Robbie Robertson's friend way back in those pre-band teenage years in the band called The Hawks. Here's Robbie.
And as a person, too, Levon was just an amazing character, because going down there as a kid, like I did, it was like going to the holy land of music. This is where blues grew out of the, you know, grew right out of the ground. So to have somebody like him, you know, introduce me to that world and take me, you know, inside that world so quickly, like I was just automatically a part of it and a part of his family and everything. I mean, it just meant a tremendous thing for me getting my confidence and my act together and being able to, you know, start playing the guitar as quickly and with all of the coolest influences all around and everything as one could ever hope for. I admired his musicianship tremendously, and he played guitar before he played drums.
I didn't know that.
And when he started playing drums, he not only played them, he owned them. And, you know, I mean, he just became an extension of this instrument to such a degree. It was it was fascinating just to see him play, let alone what he was playing, but the whole package. And he was really young too, and doing, you know, playing so explosively and swift, and his drums had just the coolest sound that I'd ever heard.
Recorded in New York City on New Year's Eve 1971 with the Memphis Horns, that concert emerged as the seminal Rock of Ages double album set.
Tell me about writing Ophelia from Northern Lights, Southern Cross.
There is a certain musical flavor in this song that I was, it was when you were saying held up and timeless and those kind of things, it's a style, it's a chord progression style that goes way back into the 1920s, I think. And I wanted to write a song that incorporated these kind of chord changes. And so when I started messing around with the idea, there was a certain humor to a certain sadness in this song, and I liked the combination of fitting these two things together, that something could be, you know, a little heartbreaking but without losing its sense of humor at the same time. So it was a combination of those elements, this really old-fashioned-y type chord change, but the treatment that I gave it, you know, in this song and what we did and the way Garth played on it and the way Levon sang it and the way we played it and everything, it didn't resemble that old-fashioned-y thing at all. But nevertheless, that was the basis for something that I was trying to do. And when all the pieces of this puzzle, of that song, Ophelia, came together, to me, in its own way, that was a little piece of one of those things where you say, you know what, that's just right. That tune there, the way that came out, that's just right. So it's something to this day that I feel that mixing those flavors together did provide something kind of unique and very special in my own and memories of music with the band.
You know who I always imagined would sing Ophelia? The only person that would have sung it equally as good as Levon, he would have had a white handkerchief in one hand and a trumpet in the other.
You know, I think you could be right about
that. Am I
that.
Right? Come on.
I never thought about it.
Oh,
but
come on.
But some of those chord changes are chord changes that those guys like King Oliver and some of those people did play. And it would have been wonderful to hear Satchmo do a version of Ophelia.
Gosh, yes.
Absolutely. That's a good idea.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure with the electronics, somebody's going to make it happen someday, too.
Ophelia, written by Robbie Robertson and sung by the late Levon Helm, sounds like it was written 50 years earlier than its 1975 release on the band's album Northern Lights, Southern Cross. Still to come, Robbie Robertson eulogizes both Richard Manuel and Rick Danko and sets the record straight on how and why the original quintet, the band, called it a career. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter, at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard in the studio with Robbie Robertson for the conclusion of The Best of the Band.
Welcome back. In the studio, I'm Robbie Robertson with Redbeard.
Please clarify something for me. In early fall 1976, exactly what did you tell the members of the band that you needed to do? Simply stop touring, or that you were leaving the band completely?
I didn't really have any intentions of leaving the band. I knew that something had to be done to make it snap out of the state that it was in. Let me just clarify a bit. Though that particular period, this was the end of a whole innocent period that started in the 60s with people experimenting with lifestyles and drugs and the whole thing that you see in the Woodstock film and all of that. And in the very beginning, it all had a true innocence and an adventureness to it. And as time went on, it started to become like, do you really want to dance with the devil? And it was like, okay, this is changing. And by the time we got up towards the period of doing The Last Waltz, there was a dark cloud and hanging over music at that time. And so many of my friends were under that dark cloud. Well, I didn't even know anybody who in some way or another wasn't a part of this. And I could tell that some of these people just weren't going to make it, that they were going to die playing this game. And we did not have the information at the time to say, you know what, this is a disease, and some people can, you know, dabble with things, and other people, it's going to take them down and kill them. And there's a big separation here for one person's, you know, just casual enjoyment, and another person is on a death trip. Some of this starts to need to be defined. And out there on the road, traveling, it was just out of control to me. So what I told the other guys was, listen, the situation that we're in personally, how we're involved, how this disease has come into our home and affected us and our loved ones, we need to stop the train and get off. We need to do what we need to do so people can take care of themselves, so we can go on and do what we do really well. And I want to get off the road. I've done this. I don't want to do it anymore. It's dark out there. And so everybody was like, we need to do something. And this is at least somebody saying something, or we have a starting place here. And that was my initial idea in this. And that once everybody had a chance to get their feet on the ground, we could sort some things out without being in the spotlight, this would be a healthy and a smart and good thing to do. Well, after The Last Waltz, and in that period that was designated for these purposes, it didn't really happen. It just became more of the same, and in some ways even more dangerous. So we weren't able to really, you know, pull the pieces together like what the plan hopefully would be. And things just stayed in that limbo there until everybody just went off in their own different directions and started, you know, following their own path. But that was not the idea to begin with. So that's how, you know, I put it to everybody. And I said, and if we are going to, you know, we've lived half of our lives on the road. If we were going to give up this part of our lives, let's do it. Let's go out with a beautiful celebration, a beautiful musical celebration. And that's, you know, that's where that whole idea came from.
Tell us, those of us who didn't have the good fortune to know him, tell us about Richard Manuel, the musician, and Richard, the person.
Richard was in the group. He was amongst us, like, the most legitimate of the singers.
Really?
Yeah. That's the way everybody felt about Richard. Like, he had the biggest range. He had the fullest tone. If there was something, a song that really needed some extra special kind of singing or something, everybody would vote that Richard would have to do that. When we were figuring out harmonies and things, it would always be Richard would have to take the highest part because he's the one that could hit it the easiest. And so the Richard's voice was like a big part of it. He was the reason that he was invited to join the Hawks originally. And the fact that he also played piano as well. But it was really the tonality of that vocal that had everybody mesmerized. And then when we got to know Richard, he was just such a great guy, such a fun person, and a such a genuine heart. You know, there was nothing about Richard that you just didn't love, except that he would be inclined to maybe drink too much now and again. And as we now know about this thing, that it's a progressive disease. And over time, you know, it got worse and it got worse, and he got just deeper into that place. And for all of the love and gift that Richard carried, that would be, you know, ultimately that would be really, really stepped upon by his alcoholism. And it was just sad to see this, you know, the beautiful part of Richard just being taken over by this demon. And you know, and we tried everything we knew at the time. We tried warning him. We tried threatening him. We tried locking him in a room. We tried everything that we could. And of course, just because we were so, you know, ignorant in what works and what doesn't work and all of this, we did, sure. I'm sure, all the wrong things, yeah. All the things that don't work.
No, you weren't equipped.
We're not equipped. But right. I miss Richard dearly. I just had so many great times with him.
Robbie Robertson concludes his tributes with his characterization of the band singer, bass player, Rick Danko.
Rick was, he was the most outgoing character in the band. He was somebody that in 3 minutes you felt like you had known for a lifetime. There was nothing that Rick was holding back. He shared everything there was to share in immediately with you. It's so forthcoming. And one of the most unique bass players ever in the history of this music. When we first started playing concerts out there, he played an Ampeg fretless bass and sang. And only musicians would know, but this is an extraordinary feat. They don't call it a fretless bass for nothing. You cannot visually tell where you're supposed to be. It's all by ear. And Rick had one of the most amazing ears of anybody I've ever met. You could hand him any instrument from any country in the world, and in 10 minutes, he'd have something going on it. He'd be playing that sucker and making it sound good. He had just music just pouring out of every pore in his body. And was just so much fun. Just so much fun to make music with, so much fun, you know, to be with. And he was one of those people that you could call anytime, night or day. And if there was anything, any problem, he was there, you know, in seconds. I mean, he really, with Rick, you always had a feeling that he completely had your back.
Acadian Driftwood comes from the band's Northern Lights Southern Cross album from 1975. Robbie Robertson presents the band box set, remastered on premium vinyl.
In a package like this, and putting this together, like here, once and for all, this is it. This is the musical history of the band, you know, with all of these, you know, over 100 songs. It's the first time that I feel like I'm saying to the public, come on back here in the back room and let me show you a couple of things. Let me play you something that that I've never played for anybody before. It feels like that, and it's because of the nature of this musical history. It all fits and it all works, and exactly the way it's all laid in here, and the whole musical journey and everything. It's a ride that I'm very, very proud to now share with the public.
That band box set is a click away at Amazon.com. I'm Redbeard. We'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guest, Robbie Roberts. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard. For Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2015. All rights reserved. Transcription, Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.